Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a response to President Obama's recent remarks on race and a reaction to the demonstrations taking place across the country in response to the verdict acquitting George Zimmerman for shooting the unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin. Charles Gallagher, a professor of sociology and the chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at La Salle University, and author of Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sunbelt, joins us to discuss why a lot of whites cling to the fiction that race relations are no longer a problem in America. Then we will speak with Aubrey Hendricks, a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University and author of The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. We will discuss how the president might build on his powerful speeches on race that many feel do not go sufficiently beyond rhetoric, to address the reality of race relations in America, brought into focus by the flagrantly unjust killing of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of his killer. Then finally, we'll go to Israel to speak with Gideon Levy, who is a columnist for Haaretz and the author of The Punishment of Gaza. His recent article, The Israeli Patriots' Final Refuge Boycott, has gained international attention and might have broken the law in Israel. With peace talks between Israel and Palestine resuming tentatively and reluctantly, we will discuss Gideon Levy's contention that change won't come from within unless Israel pays a price for the occupation. And joining us now is Charles Gallagher, who is a professor of sociology and a chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at La Salle University. He's the editor and co-editor, respectively, of two new books, New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sunbelt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Gallagher.
Pleasure to be here, and thank you.
And I guess if Florida is a part of the Sunbelt, it's not changing enough, right?
No, it's not.
Maybe it's changing in the wrong direction with these, stand your ground laws as well.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, there has been changes, and if you look at the polling data, and the polling data has moved monotonically. That is, it is in one direction, and the direction tends to be towards greater tolerance. But I think polling data covers over larger structural issues. I think it's easy in polling data to say that you wouldn't mind working with someone that was black. It's very different in terms of how people really live out their lives, where they live, where they send their kids to school. If you happen to have a son or daughter and they bring someone home across the color line, what that means for the family dynamics. So, I mean, I think that the president's talk was, a week in coming. And obviously, he waited a week until he finally went up to the podium to talk about Trayvon Martin, which I think is a tad long. And quite honestly, I thought that his presentation was quite heartfelt, but I thought that it was a tad anemic. And I think certainly that as the president, as a black man, he experienced these things. But once again, President Barack Obama was in front of the American population, and he did not talk about what needs to be done. And that conversation has yet to happen.
Well, do we know what needs to be done? I mean, what do you believe needs to be done?
Well, I mean, I think what should have happened over the last, since his second term, is that he could very easily have pointed out the ways in which institutional racism is still very much embedded in American life, political life. And this, again, this is where social science comes in. This is not about opinion. It is very easy to look at lots of sociologists doing very good work, and anything from stop and frisk. I mean, it's a very good example. The state of New York is being sued basically because it's a violation of black and brown civil rights. But the larger point is that if you look at who does drugs in the United States, whites and blacks do drugs at the same rate. And if you were to come into my neighborhood, which is a first-rung suburb of Philadelphia, it's white, it's affluent, and you started pulling kids over randomly, whites between the ages of 18 and 30, you would absolutely find marijuana, you'd find Ritalin, you'd find ecstasy, you'd find drugs. But we don't police out here. We don't stop people. We don't stop someone that's white, driving that's 20 years old and basically do a pat down. If we did, we'd have white middle class kids filling the jails. That would never happen because white middle class America would never let it happen. So I mean, just stop and frisk is just one example. We could talk about schooling. We could talk about wealth disparities between blacks and white. We could have access to health care. All these things are structural. And the problem with color blindness today, and whites are very invested in the colorblind narrative, is that if you say that we're now colorblind, a few things happen. If you don't make it, you can blame the person, right? So if someone doesn't become president or the CEO or can't get a job, you don't say that it's systemic discrimination. You say there's something wrong with the individual or there's something pathological about the culture of those people. And the second thing that colorblindness does for whites, it means that if you say the playing field is level, it means there's no such thing as white privilege. So it erases the notion that somehow being white in the United States is a benefit. So there's a lot of ideological work going on. And the president has, quite honestly, I mean, if you remember a while ago, the Henry Louis Gates affair, where he had a beer. He met with a cop that arrested the Harvard professor. He actually had a beer summit, and he got in trouble for it. And he got a little burned from that, and he basically, after that, never discussed race again. And in this situation, he had to because of the riots. I mean, he waited a week, quite honestly, to get ahead of this and to discuss the matter. So, I mean, the one thing a president should do is use the bully pulpit, and he has not done that.
Well, but he did, surely he did that on Friday. I mean, and demonstrations have taken place over this weekend. It's not like this issue is going away. And he did also mention in his speech the criminal justice system and how blacks are disproportionately involved in the criminal justice system. And then in black neighborhoods, there is a lot of black on black crime. He did at least address all of these issues, and I guess the question now is, what is the follow-up? And again, what do you think is the follow-up or should be the follow-up?
Well, I think it's interesting that you can't point to something the president said about a follow-up. What he said was, I thought, was interesting because the words matter. He thought it was more appropriate that people talk about these issues in the small places, in the small places of your family, of your church. And, you know, what that's really saying is that he doesn't want, I mean, you could think about what LBJ did. I mean, LBJ took what Kennedy started with civil rights agenda, and he passed through some of the most radical civil rights legislation in American history. And this was a man that had a history, LBJ, of engaging in really racist behaviors. And he came to a kind of, I guess, a moral epiphany, and he said, you know, this is what we got to do. As he said, we've lost the South forever. And that is, this president, LBJ, was willing to basically say, okay, I'm going to do the right thing. I don't see from the president, there are lots of things one could do. One could bring in federal enforcement. One could toughen laws. The president could do many things. He didn't outline one thing, not one, in his speech.
Well, he specifically said that this is something that he doesn't feel politicians can handle.
Well, I mean, so then he's just basically passing the ball to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
What is the role of the federal government when it comes to guaranteeing the rights of citizens? Trayvon Martin's rights, what I really believe, it's another indication that the rule of law doesn't apply equally to everyone. That is, that if in the rule of law, if everyone is expected to be treated equally in the eyes of the law, it's just not the case for most blacks in the United States. So, I mean, there's if you wanted to start to enforce things, you could, and you could use the feds to do it. But again, I don't think if the president talks about race, I mean, here's the problem. The way that color blindness works now, that if you even talk about race, it means you're a racist. Because if people believe that the color line has been erased and that the playing field is now level, the people that are bringing up race are either race baiters or they're making their living through it, you know, and so that's the dilemma. This is this kind of catch-22, is that people don't want to talk about race because they say we don't need to talk about race any longer because our parents took care of that stuff during the civil rights era. So this is the kind of, this is where we happen to be. And I teach, you know, 18 and 19 year olds. They believe, they honestly believe that the playing field is level, in part because they watch television, and television is filled with multiracial cast of characters in different shows. And they see folks on television, and they think, well, you know, they're represented, and they look good, and they're driving a nice car, and they're getting a girl or getting a boy. So the reality that people construct for most white Americans is not because they have best friends that are across the color line or because they live in integrated neighborhoods. It's because they watch television. And a generation, you know, if you're 20 or below, you've been weaned on a diet of shows that show people drinking beer, eating pizza, sleeping together. So my 18-year-olds, and these kids are bright at LaSalle, they come in, and I have to work just to get them to see that there is still racial inequality. And, of course, I pull out the numbers. You can look at incarceration, graduation of high school rates, who goes to jail, all these things, who has access to medical care, the dime on the dollar of wealth disparities. I mean, so there are many ways that sociologists can point at to disparities which reflect really institutional processes. The problem is 18-year-olds come to my class and they think that everyone has equal opportunity. And that's the biggest fight I had, is saying, whoa, let's back up. So here's the problem. How do you have a conversation about something where people feel there isn't a problem?
Well, again, I'm speaking with Charles Gallagher, who's a professor of sociology and the chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at LaSalle University. He's the editor and co-editor, respectively, of two books, New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics in a Changing Sun Belt. Well, clearly, a lot of people, not just the Sean Hannitys of this world, who made some outrageous remarks in response to the president's remarks on race the other day. The Supreme Court recently ruled against the Voting Rights Act. You know, basically gutted the core of the Voting Rights Act because they contend that we don't have a problem anymore, which is right. Which is this comfortable white narrative. What do you think is the psychological underpinning of that white narrative? Is it because if you believe this, that you no longer have to be guilty about the extraordinary history of repression of African Americans in this country that the country in effect fought a civil war over, and then when the slaves were freed, they were then re-imprisoned by Jim Crow, and it was only until, as you mentioned, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, the very act that the Supreme Court recently struck down, that Lyndon Johnson realized that he would do the right thing, but he would lose the South. And now, of course, we know the Republican Party has become a Southern party.
Well, I think it's very interesting to me that you know, someone like Hannity, the comments he made that it could have been, I mean, it was really despicable, his comments. You know, I mean, I think there's a few things that, I think part of the disrespect that is directed at the president is because he's black. No right-wing talk show person spoke that way about Clinton, really, for the most, but I guess some people.
What about George W. Bush, though? The left piled on relentlessly about what an idiot and a joke he was, and a jerk.
Yeah, I mean, but you know,
I did it myself, I must confess.
Right, I know the gaffes were real, the things that he said. Saying that the president is like Trayvon Martin because he smokes marijuana and does lines of cocaine is really, I mean, that is not someone, you know, hacking up a word or misstating where a country was. It's very different. But I think also what Hannity was really getting at, if you don't like the message, attack the messenger. And what that is it's very smart distraction. You know, so he doesn't really have to talk about what is the real issue here. And that, let's be honest, the real issue here is that for many white Americans, Trayvon Martin was in fact a criminal until he could prove otherwise. And this is, if you look at how people think about stereotypes, the fact is that Trayvon Martin in the imagination of many whites in the United States, is guilty until he can demonstrate through body language or dress or the way he presents himself that he's not a criminal. So there's that going on. And I think it's interesting also that the first thing that happened after the Voting Rights Bill was basically trashed, Texas, Florida, Georgia, they put in place immediately provisions that required people to have multiple forms of ID, and well knowing that certain groups are going to be disenfranchised. And who are they? They're the elderly, and they're people of color, and the poor. So, I mean, this is literally the day, I mean, someone actually did how many hours it took before these states put in full force the need to basically have greater forms of identification. And it's a way to disenfranchise people. So, I mean, you know, and these are states that historically, there's a reason why the feds required them to do this. These were places that basically constantly created mechanisms to make sure that these groups could not vote. So, you know, this is, again, it's cynical. These things are so horribly cynical. And, you know, who is calling out these folks? You know, and you know, to top it off, it's hilarious to read, you know, Clarence Thomas's opinions on these things. You know, here's a man who would benefit enormously from affirmative action, would never have found himself in the situation he is now, but he wants to pull up the rope for other people that basically might be able to grab a hand onto it and move themselves up and out.
Well, we've had a similar African-American fellow called Ward Connolly here who brought about, on the basis of what they call reverse discrimination, basically ended the University of California's requirements in terms of giving you know, minority students access to education here in California. And since this idea that we have reverse discrimination, that somehow the whites are an oppressed minority in this country, the University of California's enrollment of particularly of African American Latinos has just gone down.
Yeah,
I mean, we know the results. So you have this extraordinary rhetoric on one side. Do they believe it, or they're just incredibly cynical, these people?
Well, I think it's a combination. You know, I mean, if you really want to make a name for yourself quickly and you're African American, then toe the most reactionary right wing line you can basically do. You know, if it's Shelby Steele, if it's, you know, and again, I find that some of these people are just hacks. But I think that, and I don't want to say self-loathing, but I think a lot of folks believe that, and I believe these folks are delusional, that they really believe that the color line should never matter. And, you know, quite honestly, Ian, I would also like to be in that camp. I would like to live in a colorblind world where maybe the only thing that color represented was culture, people's different backgrounds. But, you know, I'm a realist. I'm also a social scientist. And, you know, it's hard for me. The research I'm doing now, I'm looking at what do whites believe? And what I've come to my own conclusion after interviewing whites all over the country and studying racial attitudes for two decades is that there is a big slice of white America. They're not racist like the way we think about Jim Crow racism or biological racism. These folks, you know, they may harbor stereotypes, as we all do because we're human. But there's a big slice of white America that honestly, truly believes that the playing field is level. We live in a post-race, post-civil rights country where racial discrimination is no longer a problem.
And we have a black president.
Exactly. And again, Exhibit A is Barack Obama. And, right. And on top of that, and this starts to get into basically how whites see themselves now as victims, on top of that, you have a majority of whites, some 53%, now believe that discrimination against whites is as bad as discrimination, but that is, it is as frequent. So, and I'm thinking, you know, it's like, who are these folks? I mean, I don't know. I know lots of white people, but I don't hear any of my white friends saying that a cop pulled them over constantly or they got stopped three times. I mean, I just don't know. Now, maybe there's age discrimination, which, of course, does happen in the labor market. But the idea that whites now position themselves as being a victim in this kind of world of race consciousness, to me is shocking, and it's, again, it's not borne out by the statistics at all.
Well, Charles Gallagher, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Gallagher, who's a professor of sociology and chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at La Salle University. He's the editor and co-editor, respectively, of two new books, New Directions in Race Research and Below the Belt, Race, Ethnicity, Labor, and Politics. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a visiting scholar in religion and African-American studies at Columbia University.
Shot down in the street.